Welcome to this edition of DCS Talks, a podcast production of the Tennessee Department of Children's Services. The intention of DCS Talks is to promote dialogue among child welfare professionals, foster parents, and the entire community about ways to prevent child abuse and neglect.
In this episode of DCS Talks, we have Susan Kovac with us to discuss the Indian Child Welfare Act. Ms. Kovac serves as the General Counsel Emeritus at Department of Children's Services, where she has been the lead attorney for the Knox County region, as well as serving as an associate professor at the University of Tennessee Knoxville School of Law for over 13 years. Ms. Kovac has many special interests around law and child welfare, one of which is about the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, as we often refer to it. ICWA provides guidance to states regarding the handling of child abuse and neglect and adoption involving Native American children and sets minimum standards for the handling of these cases. This November 2023 is National Native or Indigenous American Heritage Month. To help us gain greater insight into child welfare in relation to Native Americans, we are fortunate to have Ms. Kovac share this information with us today. Ms. Kovac, welcome to DCS Talks, and thank you for joining us.
Hello, Serena. I'm delighted to be here, and hello to all of you listening.
Thank you so much. Very special to have your level of expertise on DCS Talks. I really appreciate you because you've had a long career in child welfare, lots of special interests. Could you tell us a little bit about your service to the department?
As you said, I spent time as an associate professor at UT College of Law, and there I was supervising students in the UT Legal Clinic. Much of our work was in Knox County Juvenile Court, where we represented parents or were guardians ad litem for children. In 1991, I switched to the Department of Children's Services. It was then the Department of Human Services. Some say I switched sides because I had been representing parents and I started representing the department. So I spent the rest of my career as a supervising attorney for the Department of Children's Services, handling, as you noted, abuse and neglect and adoption cases.
Well, thank you for your service and all of your expertise. And I know one of your interests is in history, specifically sensitized to ICWA. Can you provide some history about the Indian Child Welfare Act and why the legislation is important?
Sure. Let me start by clarifying that ICWA applies to Indian children, and that's a particular legal term. We're not talking about Native American children. There are many children, millions of children with Native American heritage who wouldn't be covered by this act because they don't meet that legal definition of an Indian child. And that definition is a child who is a member of an Indian tribe, enrolled in the tribe, or as some would say, a citizen of an Indian nation, or who is the child of a member and personally eligible for membership. And it has to be a federally recognized tribe. If they don't meet that definition, they could have Native heritage, but they wouldn't be considered Indian children for purposes of the law.
Gotcha. So, for instance, my great-great-grandmother was supposedly Cherokee, but I don't have any record of that. I would not fall under this law because I don't identify or I'm not in a tribe, and I may or may not have Native American heritage.
There are many people who claim Cherokee heritage, and they may well have Cherokee heritage, but unless they're enrolled or they meet the definitions for membership from each tribe, and each tribe has its own. Eastern Cherokee and Western Cherokee are different. They don't qualify under this act.
Gotcha. And I know that that often comes up, so I really appreciate the clarification. So, Ms. Kovac, please provide us with some history about the Indian Child Welfare Act and why the legislation is important.
ICWA was enacted in 1978 as a direct response to the mass removal of Indian children from their families during the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And actually, the forcible removal of Native children from their families began much earlier, with the internment of Indian children in federally run boarding schools across America as late as the in the late 1800s. These schools were designed, and here I'm quoting, to withdraw Indian children in their tender years entirely from the camp of their savage parents and to teach them to eat, to sleep, to dress, to play, to work, and to think after the manner of the white man. If coercion weren't enough to get the children away, the government sent soldiers in to seize them and put them in these boarding schools. In 1900, there were 20,000 children in Indian boarding schools. And once there, they were given new English names. Their clothing was taken away. They weren't allowed to talk their own language. We know now that many of them were routinely abused and many died. In 1925, a report noted that 83% of Indian children were being housed in boarding schools and recommended that that establishment be stopped. The move to close the boarding schools didn't really pick up speed until the late 40s, early 50s. Then, at the time when the boarding schools were being closed, the move to have Indian children adopted by white families started picking up speed. So we had something called the Indian Adoption Project that was run by the federal government and was a move to place Indian children into white homes. That went on from 1959 to 1976, and the estimate is that 12,000 Indian children were adopted by white families, were removed from their homes with really no safety issues, maybe senses of poverty, but no safety issues. So by 1978, when this law was passed, the decimation of the Indian families and the conditions in which Indian children had been held was pretty bad. At that point, 25 to 35% of Indian children were in foster care. 85% of those who were in foster care were outside their tribal communities. When that was presented to Congress, the Indian Child Welfare Act came into existence and required much more care in the removal of Indian children from their homes, and then in keeping them within their tribal communities and not removing them to white families.
Sure, but some of the schools are still going.
So the schools have really changed. The law was enacted in 78, but
78.
By then, the use of the boarding schools had declined quite a bit, but there were still a lot of children being removed by state child welfare agencies, being removed from their homes and being placed with white families.
And tell us a little bit, for our case managers, we ask, are you a member of an Indian tribe at every visit, practically, especially when we first meet a family? What should a case manager do if a family says that they are Indians?
Well, first question is to remember the standards. To be an Indian child under ICWA, you have to have a parent who is enrolled, or the child has to be enrolled, and it has to be a federally recognized tribe. There are over 500 tribes that are federally recognized. Half of them are in Alaska, and we often don't think about Alaskan natives as being Indians, but Alaskan villages are considered Indian tribes, and about half the federally recognized tribes are there. So trying to distinguish between what's native heritage and what is actually enrolled in a tribe, if a worker, the case manager, hears something in the family story that suggests there might be dealing with an Indian child, we need to follow up on that immediately. The only way to really determine whether someone is eligible for enrollment or is enrolled in a tribe is to talk to the tribe. Each tribe has its own standards, just like being a citizen of France or being a citizen of Germany. Those countries make their own decisions. Each tribe makes its own decisions. So we need to contact the tribe and just ask, is this parent enrolled in your tribe? Are these children eligible to be enrolled in your tribe? You can find the agent. Most tribes have somebody who is assigned to handle ICWA questions. And with the internet, it's really easy to find them.
Where has this come up in your career in Tennessee?
Based on the themes we've just discussed, ICWA applies only to Indian children who meet that standard. So there are a lot of tribes around New Orleans who are not federally recognized. Don't let your TPR be delayed because somebody claims, oh, I'm a member of this New Orleans tribe. You need to check and see if it's a federally recognized tribe. As I mentioned, Alaskan villages are recognized. And we've had an Alaskan village parent who didn't even realize she qualified under ICWA. So she answered the questions about, are you Indian? No, she wasn't Indian, but she was Alaskan and we didn't catch it. We want to be sure that we recognize federally recognized tribes, but we don't want to hold up adoptions dealing with people who just have Native heritage but can't identify a federal tribe. As I said, the tribes decide, and each tribe is different. In my career, which has been sort of lengthy, I've dealt with a particular extended multi-generational family of Choctaw. The first generation I dealt with, those children were eligible for membership. In fact, they already have been members. And when we contacted the Choctaw, they said, oh, yes, these are our kids. Bring them back down. One of the things the tribe can do is it can remove the whole case to the tribal court. And that's what the Choctaw did. The next generation of this multi-generation family, the children were eligible, but were not yet enrolled. And we called the tribe, and the tribe said, yes, we're interested, but just keep us informed about what's going on, which is one of their alternatives. The next generation after that, when we contacted the tribe said, don't bother calling us anymore. We're too distant, too many generations away from our rules. And these people are no longer eligible. So you have to contact the tribe. Another thing to remember is that status can change during your case. The parents, if the parents were eligible, they might go get enrolled in the middle of your case. And then it would become an ICWA case, even though it didn't start out that way.
And get the tribe involved.
Yeah, exactly. If you have an Indian child, then you have to deal with the placement priorities of ICWA. And that means for a child in foster care, the number one preference is family. And that could be non-Indian family or Indian family. It's just family. If you can't place with family, it's supposed to be placed in an Indian foster home, preferably a foster home from the same tribe. We don't have any way of keeping track of that. So the only way to find out is to talk to the tribe. For that, one of my cases, it meant taking a baby away from the Knox County foster family that thought they were going to adopt him and sending him to a Western Cherokee couple living in Memphis who were licensed by the Western Cherokee tribe. And that's just the law. It's meant sending a couple boys to their grandparents on the reservation in Oklahoma because that's priority. So that comes up in our placements. The tribe has the option of, as I said, moving the case to the tribal court. We've sent a CPS worker to the Choctaw to testify about sex abuse in a case on the tribe's reservation. It could mean that they just want to be informed. It could mean that they want to actually take total responsibility. We're going to take the children. We're going to take the whole case. Everything moves to Cherokee, North Carolina, and that's their choice. But they can do it anytime they choose. So you could get your dependency and neglect case moving right along. And just about the point you get ready to TPR, the tribe says, oh, wait a minute, we want them now with us.
Right.
A problem with it being an Indian child case is that the burden of proof is higher. So for a TPR with an Indian child, I would have to prove that case beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's really good to do.
Tell me a little bit about that, having a higher burden of proof on Indian cases. Why did that come to be?
Just to be sure that the state is making real serious efforts to keep the family together. We're exercising both the court and the agency this heightened level of analysis to be sure that we're doing it, not just, well, this is seems right, but that it's beyond a reasonable doubt. that protects the Indian child. So we're talking about the parents of an Indian child. So the non-Indian mom gets the same protection that the Indian dad would get, because we're looking at the rights of the child.
We had a lot of conversation around ICWA because there was a recent ruling by the Supreme Court literally a few months ago here in 2023. Could you explain what that case was about and what the ruling means going forward?
Sure. That case was really significant. Those of us who've been interested in ICWA were following it from the very beginning because it looked like it was headed to the Supreme Court. And there was some concern that it would totally obliterate ICWA. In fact, the opposite. That case began in 2016, and the name of the case is Brackeen, because the initial family that brought the case were the Brackeens. They're a white couple from Texas, and they began fostering Zachary. He was the seventh child born to a drug-using Navajo mother and Cherokee father. He was initially placed with his paternal grandmother, but at 10 months of age, he went to the Brackeens, and they were told, he's not going to be available for you to adopt because he's an Indian child. But 16 months later, when he hadn't been moved, they filed their own adoption petition. The Navajo Nation intervened and objected to the adoption, citing ICWA, and the trial court agreed and denied their adoption petition. So they appealed. They actually filed a federal lawsuit. They were joined by the states of Texas, Louisiana, and Indiana, and by two other prospective adoptive couples who claimed that ICWA was prohibiting them from adopting Indian children. So they claimed that the law was unconstitutional because it was based on race. They contended that it was putting the interests of tribes ahead of those of children, and it was giving the federal government too much power over adoptions and family issues, which are really not part of the federal government's responsibility. That case was heard by a federal judge in Texas. It was heard on two different appeal panels in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and finally made it to the Supreme Court last November. By then, a total of 497 Indian tribes, 62 American Indian organizations, 87 members of Congress, 23 states, and Washington, D.C. had all filed briefs in the Supreme Court asking that ICWA be upheld. It was an important case, not just because it threatened the protections of ICWA, but because it really was a challenge to the sovereignty of the tribes, to the tribes functioning as independent sovereign nations able to make their own decisions. And to have, from our original constitution, independent treaty rights as separate nations. On July 2nd, the Supreme Court ruled 7-2 to uphold ICWA in its entirety. All the claims the plaintiffs made were rejected. So going forward, we should make diligent efforts to identify Indian children as quickly as possible, to ensure that their tribes receive notice as quickly as possible, because we don't want to find out halfway through this case that we've got an Indian child who should have been placed differently, an Indian child that gives us different legal requirements. We don't want that happening further down the road. We want to know about it right away. And we want to ensure that we have placement priorities done based on what ICWA requires. There is a federal regulation that requires the court to ask at the first hearing in any case, if there's anybody in the room who knows or has reason to believe that this is an Indian child, and to put that in the record. We should be doing that in every preliminary hearing, every case. Could this be an Indian child? Most of the time, the answer will be no. But the consequences, if we miss it, are really severe, and we don't want that to happen. We ask about the importance of this case. Justice Gorsuch wrote a concurring opinion, meaning he wrote an additional, in his own words, why this opinion was right. And this is his quote. In adopting the Indian Child Welfare Act, Congress exercised that lawful authority to secure the right of Indian parents to raise their families as they please, the right of Indian children to grow in their culture, and the right of Indian communities to resist fading into the twilight of history. All that is in keeping with the Constitution's original design. That's the importance of this case.
The big takeaway from what you just stated for us is to ensure that that question is asked at the first hearing, and really for DCS to know the answer to that question before we ever get to the first hearing. So,
absolutely.
Something for all of us to be diligent about. For our listeners that are interested in learning more about ICWA, what do you recommend? Any series or books or any places for us to learn more that may shed more light on ICWA?
I'm very fond of the first two novels by Barbara Kingsolver, The Bean Trees and Pigs in Heaven. Now, those are not textbooks about ICWA. They're stories, but they're delightful reading. And if you read them, it'll give you some insight into ICWA, and you won't forget that the law exists. Now, if you really want to go into the factual stuff, this is a federal government regulation, law and regulation. So let's look at the federal government. And it's the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Office of Indian Services. It's really easy to get to on the internet. It's just BIA.OIS. That's the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Office of Indian Services. And that will take you to a website that will tell you everything you want to know about ICWA. It has links to the law, links to the federal guidelines, links to the federal regulations, both in detail, the original legal stuff, as well as in guidelines that are really easy to read. Another place that you can get a good summary is the Native American Rights Foundation, and that's just narf.org, and they put out a practical guide to ICWA, and that's also really easy reading, but gives you all the details and gives you lots of links.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Well, thank you for sharing this brief introduction to the Indian Child Welfare Act, Ms. Kovac, and thank you for joining us today at DCS Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, listener, for your interest about child welfare. Please join DCS Talks again to hear other subject matter experts discuss ways to advocate for children and build resilient communities.